call the Senate Energy Committee to order. My apologies to those of you on gavel to gavel watching us here. It's that time of the year, towards the end of session, when we end up in a holding pattern a lot of the time, and some of our committee members are engaged in another meeting. We are waiting on them, but we're going to go ahead and get started. It is the 26th of March. It is 11:20. We do have three items that have been previously scheduled on the agenda today. Present for the record are Senator Wilikowski and myself, McGuire. We're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 150 on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. And is Trevor here? There. Okay. So we'll have that come up, and then we're going to go ahead and bring up Senate Bill number 136 today. We have Joe Balash here from the administration to present that. We will not get to Senate Bill 135. So if you're online for Senate Bill 135, we'll bring that up again next week. So without further ado, Trevor, you want to come up? You put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire. I appreciate this opportunity to speak on behalf of your bill, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 150, Emerging Energy Technology Fund. Alaska has great potential to become a world leader in researching and developing new energy technologies. We have a unique combination of remote communities, abundant energy resources, both renewable and fossil-based, and a stable and attractive investment environment. Senate Bill 150 would complete that picture by creating a mechanism for the funding of new research and development energy technology projects. Senate Bill 150 establishes the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which would distribute R&D funding through a competitive grant program aimed at funding projects designed to research and test new energy technologies. The fund would be administered by the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, or ACEP. And ACEP is a University of Alaska agency whose mission is to meet state, industry, and federal demand for applied energy research in order to lower the cost of energy throughout Alaska and develop economic opportunities for the state, its residents, and its industries. The timing for the creation of a state energy research fund, like the one created by Senate Bill 150, is more critical than ever. The federal government has committed over $13 billion to renewable energy research and development through the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, and President Obama has vowed to make renewable, alternative, and clean energy technology a top and continued priority for his administration. In recent years, the U.S. Department of Energy has offered millions in federal grants that typically require a mere 20% cost share at the state level. Every $1 of state funding invested in the Emerging Energy Technology Fund could generate up to an additional $4 in federal funding. Alaska has the available natural resources, the financial means, and the political spirit to become a national and global leader in researching and developing new energy technologies. Senate Bill 150 creates the funding mechanism that will help us to achieve that goal. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your support and consideration for Senate Bill 150. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you very much, Trevor. You've done a good job of summarizing what the fund does. People have asked me whether or not the spirit of the bill came from the Alaska Science and Technology Fund that used to exist. And in part, I suppose it did, that the idea that the state could provide seed corn for important, innovative ideas is a good one, and other jurisdictions certainly do it. We have some good projects that came out of that. But what we wanted to do now is focus on alternative energy, and we wanted to make sure that it was managed appropriately. And I wondered if, just for a second, Trevor, you could talk about the discussions that you and I have had with respect to the board itself in the new CS and how that board would oversee the fund itself. That's one of the concerns that people have had, is to be sure that the kinds of grants that are given are based on technology that has some possibility of being developed, and that there's a business model for which success can be attained. So if you want to talk about that for just a second.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. As you mentioned, there is a CS we'll be asking that is adopted at this hearing. And I'd be happy to go ahead and walk through those changes real quick.
That would
and then
be
I
great.
Can address your question there. We really made two changes in the CS. The first was to add a 5-member advisory committee to carry out the business of soliciting, reviewing, and selecting grant applications. The reason we did this is in order to create another level of separation between the agency that would be administering the fund and the actual fund recipients. There were some concerns that perhaps the university might not be the appropriate agency just because they could and likely would be, if not full applicants, then they would probably partner with other applicants to apply for this grant funding. This 5-member advisory panel would create another level of separation between the two, and there are no university members that would be appointed to that board. The language we used was loosely modeled on the Renewable Energy Fund language, and it's a common model for grant programs managed at universities around the country. It avoids the conflict that would arise if a project that's partnered with the university applies for grant funding, and it allows a wide range of stakeholder voices to be included in the selection process. The other change we made was to expand the definition of eligible applicant to both public and private sector entities, including licensed businesses, nonprofits, and government and quasi-governmental entities. Again, when we first drafted the bill, we looked at some of the existing models that were out there, and some of the language that we borrowed from the Renewable Energy Fund may have been a bit too limited for who we envisioned being the recipients for this grant funding. And really, this just corrects that by expanding that definition to include specifically private sector and nonprofit entities.
Excellent. And then you want to, and did you talk about the educational experience as well that we wanted the board members to have?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just briefly, and then we'll get to Larry Persley.
We do have a requirement in the bill that each member of the committee. Well, let me back up just a little bit there. Since research and development really requires a certain level of expertise in the hard sciences, we wanted to make sure that people who sat on this advisory committee had the appropriate background. One of the ways we address that, and we borrowed this from an existing model out there again, was to require that each member of the committee shall have a degree in science or engineering and at least 2 years of experience working in the state. We found in other programs that people tend to far exceed these minimum requirements, but we didn't want somebody who wasn't savvy on the most cutting edge research and development energy technology out there sitting on the advisory board.
Absolutely. There are a lot of ideas out there, but we wanted to be sure that the ones that would be considered had merit and basis in science. Okay, thank you, Trevor. Why don't we, any further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Just on I guess the change expanding who's eligible for this. Could a private company like Exxon apply for a grant and receive it under this bill?
The way the bill, Senator Wilkowski through the chair, the way the bill is written, I don't see any reason why a company like Exxon would be excluded. Just because they apply for it doesn't mean they're going to get it. They're still going to have to go through a rigorous and stringent and very competitive grant process in order to, or review process in order to receive that grant.
And if I could follow up, what's the means by which the committee is to evaluate proposals? Is that specified in here, or is it just solely up to the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that isn't specified explicitly in the bill. I suppose we would leave that up to the discretion of the administering body, which would be ACEP, and they do have a very strong background in energy technology in the state, and I have every faith, I believe the sponsor has every faith, that they would come up with appropriate criteria.
And Senator Wilkowski, on that point, you know, it's difficult in these bills to lay out every detail, and the thinking was that the board would come together and through a process decide how the criteria would be weighted. But we do have Chris Rose online as well, and we can talk a little bit more about some of those standards that ACEP has. There is a handout in your packet as well from ACEP, And it's the kind of thing, though, as the bill moves through, if the committee gathered around any specific details about how they wanted those grants administered, we could. But again, lacking my own self, that expertise and what weight should be given in each category, I wouldn't feel comfortable putting that in the bill. So, okay, thank you. If you can just stand by. Larry Persley?
I'm Larry Persley. I'm an aide in House Finance Committee who happens to have a desk in Mike Hawker's office.
That's right. And now the Senate Energy Committee.
Well, freelancing, I guess,
yes,
through the chair. I guess I was just going to say, in terms of calling on my experience working for the state office in Washington D.C. the past year and following energy issues, clearly alternative energy, emerging technology, energy is going to be the issue du jour for several years in this country. And the stimulus bill, for which I'm spending a lot of time on, has a fair amount of research dollars available by competitive grants. You know, much of the focus here has been on the funds that are going to come to the state through formula programs for home weatherization, energy programs, energy efficiency block grants, but there's a significant amount of money in the stimulus bill. There will be significant funds in the federal 2010 budget, and my guess is in budgets in the years to come, dealing with energy technology, alternative energies, new research that will help the country reduce its reliance on fossil fuels. So, you know, as the state looks ahead, I would think the state of Alaska wants to make sure it has adequate mechanisms to go out there and give us a best shot at getting some of those research dollars. So I just thought that that's the context, I guess, that I look at this, is if the state would not want to lose out on a research grant for lack of a qualified applicant or a mechanism to do it, which is not to say that the University of Alaska system is not qualified to apply for some of those funds or other entities. The question certainly is for the legislature, is there a way to improve the state's odds of getting some grants?
Absolutely. Thank you. Questions from Mr. Persley? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Does the state having a fund available improve our odds of getting funds?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm not sure just having a fund available. It's probably more having the expertise of the people focused on pouring through Federal Register grant applications and looking for opportunities where the state could qualify, or the state could put together a program to qualify, either in partnership with the university or with the Cold Climate Research Center, the different entities we already have. Sometimes it's a matter of someone acting as a coordinator to put together a partnership, but not missing out on grant opportunities. So I don't think the fund itself, it's more just having enough eyes with the skills and the knowledge and knowing what's out there, so if we have a chance, we get in a good application.
And I agree with you completely, and I'm just trying to figure out the mechanism how this is actually going to work, and so are you envisioning that through this fund maybe we'll fund a position for someone that whose job is to go out and look for alternative energy or emerging energy technology grants?
Through the chair, Senator, I guess I hadn't thought down to that detail. The question was, are there federal dollars out there this year, the years ahead, probably is what we're looking at more rather than immediate applications. Are there federal dollars, federal programs that the state has a chance at and the state would want to make a considered effort to go after, whether it's funding a position or is this going to be, I want to say staff board members who serve for honorarium? And I don't know if you need to necessarily add employees, but you need to have someone paying attention.
Well, and on that point, that's a good question. You never know how these things develop and evolve, but the idea was to put it under the authority of the, and management, if you will, of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, because they have an administrative construct in place and a physical location and all those kinds of things. But I suspect the individual board members, you know, will take on a life of their own. They'll have their individual personalities, their individual interests, and in bringing that dynamic together, how it evolves will be interesting. But I just, you know, when we had the Science and Technology Fund, it created a natural place for people to go, as Larry was saying, to sift through the types of grants that are out there, the types of seed money, investment money. My hope is that it might even draw venture capital companies' attention towards Alaska, that, you know, that there are perhaps even companies out there that are looking for incentives like this that might consider developing or locating in Alaska based on this little nudge forward that's different and unique than somewhere else. So I think it remains to be seen. And it on purpose is not funded. It comes before this committee as a shell and an idea that can sit out there as a place. That was one of my real disheartening moments over in the other body, was when the actual statutory language was eliminated for the Science and Technology Fund. I thought that that was very short-sighted, that, you know, that it couldn't be recreated or reinvented or rethought about in years and years out into the future. So thank you very much, and thanks for all your hard work on the stimulus. It's been much appreciated. I've had a lot of constituents with feedback on that.
Thank you.
So thank you. Okay, and then we'll go to, we have got Chris Rose. Chris, are you there?
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Chris Rose, and I am the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project. We are a coalition of over 60 small, large electric utilities in the state, businesses that are involved in renewable energy development, environmental groups, consumer groups, Alaska Native organizations. We also have state and federal agencies as contributing and advisory members. And we are very much in support of Senate Bill 150. We feel that this is a niche in our energy portfolio and policy in Alaska that's very much needed to be filled. Right now, we have, of course, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, which has been using state money to fund commercial and mature technologies to get those, to get projects in the ground. But having said that, there is a huge need in Alaska to do research and development and to do demonstration projects and pilot projects. One of the reasons is that we've got, of course, very high electric rates and heating rates around the state, some of the highest in the nation. Meanwhile, we have a lot of potential resources, both renewable and fossil, around the state that could be developed. But many of those resources need to be developed using technology that's not commercial yet. Tidal and wave power is a great example. That holds a tremendous opportunity for coastal villages and communities around the state. However, that's in its infancy. And we don't have a commercial wave and tidal power that's really made its way into the mainstream yet. That is something that Alaska could have first mover advantage in, first mover status in. Battery storage is another area where Alaska could really have a huge opportunity to develop technology that could be useful in Alaska, but then exported around the world. And there are 2 billion people now on the planet with no electricity whatsoever. And so a lot of these emerging technologies that we could be developing in Alaska for Alaskans could also wind up being technology that we export, expertise that we export around the world. So it is a huge economic opportunity for the state if we can get in on some of these technologies on the front end. And one of the advantages that we have up here is because our rates are so high, we're actually able to demonstrate projects while at the same time saving money for the people who are using that technology. For instance, you know, a 45 cent per kilowatt hour tidal project is not going to help anybody in the lower 48. That could actually beat the current price for diesel powered electricity in one of our villages. So we could be saving money and demonstrating technology at the same time. We also have this huge opportunity to be attracting federal money. As more and more federal money comes into research and development, renewable energy, and also alternative energy, we have to have some kind of a program like this to even get in line for that funding. Right now, we don't have that. We don't have any program like this to even be applying. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power is well suited and positioned to administer a program like this. And I think the advisory committee that's proposed is a way to insulate the university from any kind of conflict of interest on projects that they might want to do themselves. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power is an institution that we hope will grow. Right now, for instance, in Oregon, the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center at Oregon State University, which was established a few years ago, has become a national leader in wave technology. Even though Alaska's got 95% of the wave power potential in the country, we've already been beaten out by OSU because they were a little bit ahead of us. We still have an opportunity to catch up on some of these technologies, but we have to have an R&D fund. And again, this is a shell that would be created, and then we would hope that we'd be able to attract both state and federal money into it, and a modest amount even to begin with, but it definitely is something that could help Alaska and Alaskans. So I appreciate that opportunity, and I will remain on the line for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for all your help working with me and Trevor in our office trying to get this concept off the ground. We had the idea earlier this year and have been trying to play around with the right way to put it together, and a lot of the work is your brainchild, so thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have questions. Denali Daniels. Are you there, Denali?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Denali Daniels, and I represent the Denali Commission. For those of you I haven't met, it's true, and it's just an ironic event that I share the name of the commission.
Yes.
My comments will be brief. I believe we provided a letter late yesterday, so I'm not sure if committee members have received that or not, signed by the federal co-chair.
Yes, we do.
Just by way of background, the Denali Commission is an independent federal agency. And in terms of governance structure, we have 7 commissioners. And each of our program areas operates under advisory committee structures. And those advisory committees make recommendations up to the commission in terms of both policy and project selection and funding determinations. The energy program is what we call our legacy program. And it was actually the original intent of the commission to bring deficient bulk fuel facilities into EPA compliance. And that was back in 1998. Today, our focus areas include bulk fuel, power plant upgrades, and alternative renewable. The Energy Advisory Committee has been developing a strategy for the alternative renewable program area. We currently have roughly $10 million available for that area, and part of the strategy includes emerging technologies. The Commission has historically been involved in pilot projects such as the China Geothermal Project, which I'm sure most folks are familiar with at this point. There's a hydrokinetic project up in Eagle, and as well, AVEC has a high voltage direct current feasibility project that we have fully funded. But all of those projects, and there are several others, have created efficiencies and further developed those technologies to where we feel they can actually, you know, become eligible at some point soon for the renewable fund that the state has so graciously funded over the last year. So in our eyes, you know, this initiative that's before you all is very consistent with our vision as well, that emerging technologies are instrumental to part of the overall continuum for energy development in Alaska. We have been in active dialogue with the university, specifically ACEP, REAP, of course, and as well the National Renewable Energy Lab, or NREL. We are developing a partnership for funding emerging technologies using our funding, as well as going after hopefully some stimulus funding as well. And then we're real enthusiastic about tracking this particular legislation and look forward to the dialogue here as well. The Denali Commission held its quarterly meeting last week in Juneau, And at that meeting, we heard a tremendous amount of positive testimony in support of our efforts around emerging technology, and particularly the work plan that includes emerging technology as part of that renewable program area and the funding on the table from our standpoint. Most folks are familiar with Senate Bill 150 and mentioned it in their testimony. And I guess, really, from the commission standpoint, anytime we can leverage additional resources, whether it be monetary or in kind, that's really how we see our role in the picture. We're not going to have the funding that we've enjoyed in previous years, so we're really shifting it into high gear in terms of developing partnerships and also engaging in initiatives around the stimulus package. So again, we're pleased to see the dialogue, and we hope to continue to have a seat at the table. And I think you have all the right players probably on the phone or in the room. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Denali, and thanks for all of your hard work. It was good to catch up with you when you were here and hear how you are evolving as a commission with not as much money as you've had in the past, but certainly all of the same challenges, if not more, in Alaska, and you're facing them well. And I appreciate all of your work, and we look forward to working with you, and we'll add you to the list of our resources, if that's okay for you, as the bill moves through.
Please do.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. So with that, we will then go back here to the room to Pat Pitney. And Pat's with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney, Vice Chancellor for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm actually with the UAF administration, but I am here on behalf of Gwen Holdman, who is with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. She's in a was in London at an energy conference there and is on her way home. So, but I can speak as well for the university administration. We believe that this is an essential, the fund is an essential piece for the state of Alaska to focus research on those things that will be of benefit in Alaska. Those energy funds are available nationwide. They will be used nationwide. To the degree we can apply those funds to the problems in Alaska, we are better off. As to the ownership of the fund, whether ASEP manages the fund, AEA manages the fund, Denali Commission manages the fund, it makes no difference to us. There is a level of expertise with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power that makes it a reasonable choice for that selection. I think the advisory committee is very essential. But what this also does is strengthens the tie between the university research and the application of that technology in society. So It's very good. I think the key points are the fund is essential. Who manages the fund is, we believe we would do a great job at it, but it is not essentially necessary to manage it within the university. But we are 100% behind the idea of the fund and the essentialness of the fund to attract those federal dollars to put towards Alaska's problems.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Pat. Questions? Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, next we have Bill Leedy. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Leedy, I'm a 37-year Juneau resident and small business owner. Our company, Alaska Applied Sciences, Inc., owns a wind plant in Palm Springs, 14 wind machines that I maintain. We also do some energy consulting. I've spent most of my time the past 8 years pro bono as a director of the Leedy Foundation, founded by my father 24 years ago, co-authoring research papers on the problem of transmission and firming storage for stranded renewables. We also fund nonprofit organizations to do energy policy research. Early this week, I emailed all legislators a paper that I'll present on March 31st at the National Hydrogen Association annual meeting titled Alaska Village Survival, Affordable Energy Independence via Renewables, firmed as hydrogen storage in liquid anhydrous ammonia. That's a mouthful, but it simply says, if we want to have energy independence for villages, we have to have annual scale firming storage. And that's the essence of the research that's promoted in that paper. I also testified before the Denali Commission last week, suggesting that they place $5 million of their approximately 10 available for renewable energy in this new Emerging Energy Technology Fund should it become law. And I gave them the same paper that I just mentioned. I'll give you an example of a project. Pro bono, I helped write a grant application for AEL&P, our local electric utility here, submitted, enabled by HB 152 under this renewable energy grant program. It wasn't funded, I think primarily because it was too much of an R&D project, and maybe people didn't understand that it really had statewide and particularly village application. It's a very good match for SB 150, where it might not have been a good match for the HB 152 program. It's a shovel-ready project in that the application's already been written. If SB 150 were to become law and have some funding, why, that application might go forth. It's referred to in this paper I just referred to you, the one I'll present later this month. It emphasizes storage. It's an R&D and demonstration project that would happen within the gate at AEL&P, because you want to do these research projects close to home, close to where you have good support in a major city, before you then, if it's successful, propagate it out to one of the Alaska villages. I also emailed you today a version of this bill with some suggested modifications you might want to make. Alaska has special needs and opportunities, as Chris Rose was saying. And some of those can be pioneered here, and they may have U.S. and worldwide application. So it's important that we have this vehicle in place. So I recommend that you move this out of committee, and that somewhere in the legislature it receive an appropriation.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mr. Leedy. That's exciting to hear of your foundation and of your work. And I look forward to reading the paper that you've submitted, and invite you to come back and visit with me in my office at some point in more detail. Thank you. Questions? Okay, next we have Greg Brown.
My name is Greg Brown, and thank you very much for this opportunity. 2 seconds of history about me. I was the president and CEO of Schneider Electric, both in Canada and in Latin America. Schneider operates under the brand name of Square D in the United States, but they're the biggest electrical distribution and control products manufacturer in the world. I also was the president and CEO of Xantrax, the people who made inverters, which are critical for a number of alternative energy applications. And in addition to most of the boats out here have Xantrax inverters in them. I am retired for the most part now, but I'm living here in Juneau, which is a place I love to live and always wanted to live, so I moved here. I am doing work, though, in Ontario, Canada, and I don't know if you're following what's going on there. Ontario probably has the most progressive alternative energy program in this hemisphere today. They have what they call the Renewable Energy Standard Operating Program, in which they actually have set up a, through their legislature, set up a program that attracts tremendous amounts of outside money to develop the energy, alternative energy for them. I'm working with a company called Silicon, which is Silicon Solar. They've done most of their work in Europe. They've been in Spain. They're a Spanish company, been around for a long time. And we're getting ready to do a 30-megawatt project, in solar project in Ontario. We're also in the process of working on a project that is called Plug and Play, which is designed for the First Nations applications, which is similar to the applications we might have here, where they have remote villages and they want to be able to plop these things down, basically, up to 100 kilowatts, which would take care of quite a few homes. And they would be standard components, and you could hook the components up to either wind power, solar, tidal, or any other thing that would generate power. And they would do that through the connection through the inverter. I'd like to speak out very positively toward this Senate Bill 150. About 6 months ago, I gave a presentation at the University of Alaska on Friday night at Egan on alternative energy. And in that presentation, Silicon, the company I'm working for, has done some experimentation with new windmills, which they think are cutting edge as far as being able to not have issues with icing and those things. And Silicon offered to give the university one of those windmills, free and clear, and all they wanted in return was some information back. I was told last week, after the windmill's now already been shipped from Spain on the way here, which is going to end up in my garage, that due to funding problems, that the university probably won't be accepting the windmill, which is a little bit of a concern to me, because I think it's a great opportunity to experiment with some cutting-edge products, and also with companies that have been doing this kind of thing for a long, long time, develop relationships there. The other projects that I'm working on is we've been now for about a year working on the idea of a biomass facility down in Prince of Wales Island using pellet, manufacturing pellets, and they would get the raw material from that from the thinning of the forest, which we now have reached some kind of agreement with the Forest Service on that, and sawdust from the mills down there, Kirk at Viking Mills. In addition, we just did some experimentations with cardboard when some of the issues showed up with recycling here, and we mixed cardboard and mixed paper into the wood mass, and we found we could put 5% cardboard mixed paper in this without changing the EPA emissions criteria at all in burning it. So the project down there would give you an opportunity to employ about 20 people. It would solve a lot of the issues with the recycling, and it would also provide heat. And we looked at this building here actually about a year ago with the idea of converting it from oil to woody biomass, and there would be a significant savings in doing that kind of thing. And plus, it's basically carbon neutral since the wood's going to deteriorate anyway as opposed to bringing in oil and burning it. So with those comments, I'd like to speak out in very much in favor of this bill. I think it's a good first step to making Alaska become really a technology state and being a leader in this kind of industry.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
If nothing else, this bill has brought out some of the more interesting people to testify. This is really neat. You know, these are hidden jewels that we have in our state that we don't get a lot of opportunity to be exposed to. Kirk Hardcastle.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Speaking of interesting characters, I guess I'll stack myself in with one of those. My name is Kirk Hardcastle. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Southeast Alaska, and we have identified a massive amount of a waste stream here in Southeast Alaska, and that is from fish waste. After we have been able to recover a lot of the fillets, there's a lot of stuff being pumped out into the oceans. I have a few numbers here that are absolutely mind-boggling. In Juneau alone, we are pumping about 12 to 15 million pounds of fish waste into the waters here. We're working right now in a feasibility study through AEA, and Peter Krimp is our program manager here. And we are working on the feasibility of seeing up to about 100,000 gallons of biodiesel recovered from the fish waste itself. And for those of you who can see this, this is a precursor of what we've got from fish waste, okay? This is being able to recover from what's left, and we're working through different aspects of being able to pull the oil out and how to recover that type of oil, primarily for heating and other for possible power as well. What's left after the waste products, you do need to have a viable source out of that, but that's not really in the energy. That's more in the resources committee when it gets to that. We'll talk about in those regards. We would like to be able to venture into being able to find energy resources for our fish waste. It's really essential to us that this fund goes through and rolls through because, as we had mentioned, as you just mentioned, Madam Chair, is that you're finding people coming out of the woodwork, people that you didn't know that Alaska had as far as technology and will and desire and energy to be able to make things like this happen. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and making it possible for us to be able to come out of the woodwork, so to say. One of the interesting parts, also I'm hoping that this fund will help out, is it's been on our own dime. We have gone to Finland to look at their alternative energy and emerging energy technology. It's really amazing what they've done in a lot of their older communities. that are no longer economically viable. They've literally pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps and have willed it into existence to start to venture into emerging technology. Right now, they're one of the few nations putting positive investments into alternative energies and emerging energy technologies. It's really fascinating. I went there to look at the only commercialized fish waste to biodiesel production plant in the planet. Most places, such as out in Dutch Harbor, they're using it as an in-house supplement for their own production. But in Finland, I went there to kind of look at their technologies and what they're doing. What I left with was more impressive than the technology, was their ability to redevelop a workforce from old pulp mills and old lumber mill communities and old farming communities that were primarily out of work. What they did was they revitalized a workforce, developed it into emerging energy technologies. They created vocational tech schools, spun those out to business techs right across the street, and then research technology. And right now they're spinning out all these emerging energy technology ideas throughout the rest of the world. And I found a lot of analogies that could be placed here in Alaska in those regards to be able to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We can will this into existence. I think one of the things I was really interested in was that they leveraged innovation, which is what I think Alaska can do with this bill, is to be able to leverage ourselves through an innovative status, first mover status, to be able to bring to the forefront for the rest of the world, as Chris Rose had mentioned, export our technologies, rebuild our workforce, and bring in some energies that we really need to be having here in Southeast Alaska. As a small business owner, what I think this bill will do for us is help us cross over the tipping point into commercialization. That tipping point is what we've been hanging on for about 4 to 5 years. And we'd like to be able to see that a fund like this to be able to help us cross over into the commercialized realm. I support Bill 150. Thank you very much for your time. And I have a little handout here if you'd like to see it.
Great.
Thank you so much for your
time. Give us a copy of that.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kirk. We appreciate your testimony. It's exciting. Okay. I don't see anyone else. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 150 that I've overlooked? Anyone online? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, we'll close testimony for now, and we'll set this bill aside.
Anchorage is online.
Oh, there is. Okay, my apologies. Anchorage, are you there?
We are.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and say your name and who you'd like to be affiliated with, and go ahead and offer testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Doug Johnson for the record. I'm the Alaska Projects Director for Ocean Renewable Power Company. We're currently developing two hydrokinetic projects in Alaska. One is the Cook Inlet Tidal Power Project, and the other is a river project on the Tanana in Indiana. And I'm very happy to be here to speak in favor of this bill. This is exactly what we need in Alaska. I'm the fourth generation of my family who live here and have been working in this industry now quite some time. And our company, Ocean Renewable Power, has actually benefited from the state of Maine and the state of Massachusetts, because the company actually started on the East Coast, and I'm the Alaska representative for the company. But those two states have technology funds just like we're trying to set up here. And both of those states have seen the wisdom of this, and we've been the recipient of funds from both of those technology funds, both Maine and Massachusetts. So I think that what we really got here with this emerging energy technology fund is an opportunity, but we have to really work to develop that opportunity. And I'm also currently working with Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and just want to say as an agency, I feel very comfortable when working with them. I think they're very credible and very professional, and I think they'll do a good job administering this fund if we can get it set up. You know, we're one of the very few places in the world that have the full suite of renewables available to us. Chris Rose did a wonderful job of coming, giving us that overview. But for Ocean Renewable, as we look at Alaska, we look at the potential here, it's really unfathomable in terms of what we can develop in Alaska. The biggest challenge we have is transmission and storage, is what's already been spoken. But we also have some technology challenges that we're up against as a company. And we'd love to have the opportunity to work cooperatively with the university and other universities, which are already doing, in research and development efforts to continue to further optimize our technology and be more effective in the work that we're doing, in both the Cook Inlet project and the river project in Indiana. So I speak very favorably of this
Senate Bill 150, and would love to see it happen. I think there's tremendous amount of to do in the state in terms of working with emerging technologies. You know, I'm speaking mostly to the ocean and river technologies directly, but there's also, as was spoken earlier, the transmission question, how do we do that better? What can we do with regards to storage? But there's also a tremendous amount of opportunities in working with biomass to combine heat and power, low temperature geothermal has been spoken about, and wind turbine optimization. So there's just a lot to do, but without a fund like we're talking about with an emerging technology fund, energy fund, that work more than likely won't happen. Because again, most of these are early stage. We need private sector money and public money to partner to actually make these things happen. And it's happening in other states, and I'd sure like to see Alaska get on the bandwagon with these other states that are really leaning really forward to make this happen. And with that, I just want to say I am in favor of this, and take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Questions? Appreciate you showing up there to testify. My apologies for overlooking Anchorage. The sheet of paper was slid under a stack. So next we have Kate Troll. Hi, Kate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kate Troll. I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Conservation Alliance, which is a consortium of 40 conservation groups representing about 38,000 Alaskans. I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, and Chris really hit on most of the points that I was going to raise, so I will keep my testimony short. I do want to highlight the fact that right now there's an estimate that worldwide we're looking at $55 billion a year in the clean energy business, and it's one of the very few bright spots in the world's economy. And so I think it's really incumbent upon Alaska to position itself to be a leader because of our world-class resources in terms of renewable energy. And the thing that I'm also excited about is what Chris kind of mentioned a little bit, which is the development of hybrid systems in rural Alaska. You know, with our 220 villages, we have a natural laboratory for developing hybrid systems that are more akin to trying to provide distribution energy in remote areas, something that the world is going to need. If you've got over 2 billion people in the developing world looking to kind of find levels of energy. So it's exciting that we can be a leader, not only to help projects like the tidal energy projects and the fish oil projects, but you know, we can be a leader in developing these hybrid systems that then in turn creates jobs in rural Alaska, where we very much need it. I also want to note that it's important to not only leverage innovation, but the federal funds. Mr. Persley spoke about the federal funds that might be available regarding the federal stimulus package. It's our anticipation that there will be additional funds as the Congress considers climate change and other energy-related legislation. So I think it's a very smart move for us to have this fund in place so we can not only leverage innovation, but more federal funds. And I understand that the committee substitute has already dealt with expanding the applicability to private applicants and the advisory council, and certainly support those efforts. And thank you very much for establishing this fund. We think it's a very critical step to make sure Alaska, you know, defines itself as an energy leader, or continues that stature as an energy leader. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay, and then the last person I have, unless there is someone else, is Brendan Babb.
Yes.
Brendan?
Good afternoon, Chairman McGuire and members of the Energy Committee. My name is Brendan Babb, and I am here to speak in favor of SB 150. A lot of the stuff has been covered. I don't want to waste your time by Chris Rose and some of the other speakers. About 48 years ago, JFK talked about putting a man on the moon. And now we have the opportunity to harness the moon to help man. As Mr. Johnson talked about, there's a huge amount of tidal resources here. The moon causes these amazing tides that we have, and it's a huge resource along with geothermal and wind. And this fund would allow us to do research and development and demonstration projects to harness that energy and benefit rural villages. I mean, as people mentioned, we have villages where the cost of electricity is higher than most demonstration projects. So it's a great opportunity for people to do a demonstration project and save a village money at the same time. I think a lot of lower 48 companies would be interested in collaborating with us to do demonstration projects and also say that they're saving money for that village at the same time. A lot of the world, as was mentioned, looks like rural Alaska in terms of its remoteness and lack of electricity. And a lot of those people wanted electricity, and they wanted it yesterday. So there's a huge marketplace for us to sell any technology that we come up with. And as she mentioned, it's a $55 billion industry, and it's estimated to quadruple by 2015. So there's a lot of people that are already working on this, and I think Alaska, I mean, this is our modern-day race to put a man on the moon. And sadly, the U.S. is actually kind of behind. And I think with this Emerging Energy Technology Fund and Alaska's vast natural resources, Alaska could not only be a leader in the U.S., but it could be a leader in the world. And the timing is perfect along with all the stimulus funds. So thank you for your work on this effort and your time today.
Thank you very much, Brendan, for your testimony and all of the testimony today that is focused around it as an industry as well. We spent a lot of time this session talking about alternative energy as a method of sustaining reliable energy for our culture and our state, but as a business opportunity, as a job creator, I appreciate the testimony today that emphasizes that opportunity that we have as well. Okay, the last person, Ketchikan, is online, I'm told. Wayne, Weighing.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be really brief. The other speakers pretty much covered what I had intended to say, but I'd like to thank you for holding the hearing and appreciate the opportunity to testify today to get my input into the hearing. I think that what Senate Bill 150 has some wonderful opportunities for all of Alaska's future. It's something that would be great for our workforce. We could be addressing some of the energy issues for the small communities, namely what I'm familiar with is Southeast. The small communities, Cake and Goon, are really hurting because of their power generation cost. And even in Ketchikan, as we speak, we're running the diesels right now because our lake levels are not replenishing because of the cold weather. And so instead of running the diesels, we have the potential of generating our backup power with tidal. And so we have wonderful opportunities here, and I'm really excited about this. And I really appreciate the forward thinking of this committee to get something like this in place. And thank you again for the opportunity to address these issues.
Thank you very much, Wayne. We appreciate your testimony. And be sure to be in touch with your Senator Stedman to tell him of your support.
I will. Thank
you. Okay. Thank you. All right. Anyone else online that I've overlooked? Anyone else here in the audience? Okay. So we'll close public testimony for today on Senate Bill 150 and bring it back up when we have a quorum. And with that, thank you for everyone, your patience and your testimony. We will go now to Governor's Bill, Senate Bill number 136, and we have Mr. Joe Balash here to present it. Welcome, and thanks for your patience.
Pleasure. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Special Assistant to the Governor for Energy and Natural Resource Issues.
And many other things as a sign.
Yes. Senate Bill 136 is part of the Governor's three-part plan to initiate an in-state natural gas pipeline project. The first is to secure funding in the current budget cycle, to initiate work that will help define the need for and the timing of a pipeline that can deliver natural gas to Alaskans, particularly in those areas where it's most needed, be conducting an alternatives analysis, selecting a route, applying for major permits, including right-of-way, identify the source of gas and customers, and put us on a path that brings all of these technical and commercial pieces together and create an opportunity then to sanction a project as soon as 2011. Mm-hmm. That work is being coordinated and directed by former DNR Commissioner Harry Noah. The governor's appointed him as the project manager for this effort. And so that's one track. Second track is a separate piece of legislation to make changes to the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority statutory mission, broadening the horizons, so to speak. And then finally, changes to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and the Pipeline Act. And that's what is contained here in Senate Bill 136. And those changes will help facilitate the necessary commercial and business arrangements between shippers of gas, a pipeline project, and ultimately customers that will be necessary for a commercial project to move forward. We began discussions with the interested parties in that were pursuing a bullet pipeline project, specifically NSTAR and Anadarko, late last year and early this year. And identified some of the issues that they saw as potential roadblocks, not insurmountable, but things that could be smoothed out to make the process flow a little bit easier. And the biggest issue that they've identified is that for a state right-of-way lease, current law requires that a pipeline and lessee commit to providing common carrier service on that pipeline. Now, common carrier service is the gold standard of access for shippers of gas. Basically, in general terms, a common carrier has to provide service to any and all comers when requested, and that if they reach the maximum capacity of that pipeline, they prorate the existing shippers and make room for the new entrant. And when considering the magnitude of a 20 or 24 inch pipeline from the North Slope to South Central, that project is large enough, certainly is world class, and would require some significant financial commitments on the part of the players in order to secure the financing necessary to construct the project. And so they would like to have the contractual certainty that if they get capacity, and I'm speaking as with reference to a shipper, in this case Anadarko, if they make the financial commitments necessary to develop a gas field and then want to get that gas to market, they need to be certain that they won't be prorated, that they won't lose any of their capacity in the pipe and will be able to actually follow through on the other contractual commitments they've made to customers in terms of delivery. So we began the discussions with a particular project in mind and making changes to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. And as we moved forward and came closer to the time to introduce the bill, and we're taking into consideration some of these other dynamics with regard to the role and scope of ENGDA and the need to get gas to more than just South Central Alaska, the governor asked a darn good question and wanted to know why the kind of provisions we were seeking to ask the legislature to make, if it's good enough for an in-state a bullet line, why isn't it good enough for any other pipeline? And so we have the bill in front of you drafted in a manner that would apply to all pipelines that are in-state. Now, because we had done our homework with parties interested in the bullet line, we did not necessarily have the kind of discussions or do the homework necessary to understand how these changes might apply to or impact the operations of existing pipelines in Cook Inlet and potentially future pipelines in Cook Inlet particularly. And so that is just one caveat that I would throw out there before we get into the guts of the bill here.
It's not retroactive in nature, however.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you have any legal opinions on it as to whether or not it would, are there any pipelines that are, I guess I would say, in early stages that this may impact?
There are none that I'm aware of, okay. Madam Chair, but as we go through the bill here, let me just say this is pretty complicated body of law that we're talking about, particularly in the Pipeline Act. And with your indulgence, as questions come up, I may need to reach for a lifeline. And there are attorneys on the phone, I believe, that
yes.
represent both the Department of Law and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And they will probably be able to answer most questions if I'm not able to.
Okay. So we do. We have Larry Ostrowski and Bob Stoller on the line. And I guess, so the question for either of you gentlemen would be, it does say on page 10, line 11, that the act takes effect immediately. And so that's understanding. But for the pipelines in existence there in Cook Inlet, is there any impact that you would see in terms of I guess the argument would be from their part, why are they forced to be a common carrier when looking forward, other pipelines have the opportunity to be contract carriers? I don't know if that would be the argument. Do either of you from the Department of Law have any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, this is Larry Ostrowski, Department of Law. Well, I agree with what Mr. Balash said. The bill was written to be prospective, so it would apply to anybody who's going to apply for a pipeline right-of-way lease. So it applies to every intrastate line equally.
Yeah. Okay. You want to just continue?
Question.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Senator Wilikowski. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. Question to Mr. Ostrowski. Would if a line were built in intrastate from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, would these provisions apply?
Yes, they would, Senator Wilikowski.
So would this apply to a line built under AGIA by TC Alaska to Valdez?
This is, let me just look. This line is designed for intrastate gas lines, not export lines. So this would be, if I look at, I think it's section 3, pipelines that originate and terminate within the state. I mean, the design of the line is for an intrastate line that delivers gas within Alaska. I think I need to check with Mr. Stoller here.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is Bob Stoller. I agree with what Mr. Ostrowski has said.
On that point, what if the some of the proposals out there, at least one of them, would envision the potential of supplying the LNG plant there in Kenai for export capacity. So if the line is, this is an interesting, this goes back to the FERC question about jurisdiction.
Indeed it does.
So if the line is designed for in-state, it meets the requirements under Section 3, but it's envisioned and in fact happens that export of LNG comes out of that line, then what?
Madam Chair, this is Joe. I think that the fundamental question is going to be whether or not FERC asserts jurisdiction and retains it. In the Pipeline Act, the state more or less, RCA more or less concedes federal jurisdiction and backs off in cases where that happens. And so there is, in other words, if federal law preempts state regulation, then we don't assert state regulation of those facilities or pipelines or other assets. So the question regarding a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, fortunately, TransCanada's license terms require them to abide by many of the things that we're asking for here in this bill. And with the chair's pleasure, I'll just proceed quickly through the makeup of it.
Senator Wilkowski.
I actually have some more questions.
Oh, sure.
Oh. Okay, Madam Chair. And I think this is an important area to figure out exactly who this applies to. Would this apply to a spur line that's being contemplated by ANGDA off of the main line?
I believe the answer to that question is yes. For any intrastate pipeline. And so the question will be, where does federal jurisdiction begin and end?
Thank you.
And federal guidelines, I don't know, does the FERC essentially mandate common carrier status?
Madam Chair, the FERC operates in and carries out the Natural Gas Act.
Yeah.
And under the Natural Gas Act, they provide for a contract service and the regulation of pipelines under that basis and contemplates firm service contracts. And all the provisions in the Natural Gas Act are meant to prevent discriminatory behavior by pipelines.
Yeah. So even if the pipeline on Alaska soil from one place to another contemplated export and as a result of which was regulated as a contract pipeline, it wouldn't really matter whether it was federal or state because it's going to be a contract pipe under either one.
We would hope so. Okay. With the changes contemplated here in state law, the question that gets tricky here is if there is not federal jurisdiction asserted over the pipeline, then we have state right-of-way leases that require the lessee to contract with the state that they will provide common carrier access. Now, the Pipeline Act allows for firm transportation service to be offered and regulated by the RCA, but it's an incongruity, as it were, between the Right-of-Way Act and the Pipeline Act. And so I've had the pleasure to get to know where some of these bumps in the road are and where some of these differences create some real brain teasers. And so it's trying to basically marry up the two and make sure that when the state enters into a lease arrangement with a pipeline, that we're getting the right kind of commitments from that pipeline that will protect the public interest. And that's what the Right-of-Way Leasing Act is intended to do.
Absolutely. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And do you know what the value of the state of the lease is for the state land on TAPS?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I am not aware of that off the top of my head. Would be happy to find out. And I think I think there's an annual or semi-annual rental fee.
And I'm just trying to figure out. You have you came up with a number of $1 million. Do you have a sense of what the value is of what the lease would run from say Gubik to South Central?
The $1 million threshold through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the $1 million threshold identified here in Section 3 for Section 121 mimics language in Section 120 for existing a law regarding covenants that a lessee is required to make. And this applies to leases for pipelines valued at $1 million or more. I'm not certain of the year that was put into place or into law and whether or not $1 million then is worth a particular value today, but we're trying to not create confusion in the statute and make it consistent.
And if I could, Madam Chair, if I'm reading this correctly, these covenants are triggered when you have a non-competitive lease of state land for right-of-way, for natural gas pipeline valued at $1 million or more, mm-hmm. correct?
It's for a pipeline valued at $1 million or more.
I'm not sure that's what it says. It says a non-competitive lease of state land for a right-of-way. Okay, so that natural gas pipeline, so the $1 million applies to the value of the natural gas pipeline and not to the value of the right-of-way.
Through the chair, that's my understanding.
Can I get legal to clarify that? Because I read that differently.
Are you?
This is Larry Ostrowski. That's the way we read the statute. It says for a natural gas pipeline valued at $1 million or more.
Okay.
So I understand the way you can see it both ways, but and I believe it's for the value of the pipeline, but I'll check on that, Senator.
Well, if there's uncertainty, I guess I would argue that we just clarify it and at some point in time.
Yeah, maybe it could say for a right-of-way that envisions or a natural gas pipeline. There may be a modifying word before that. On that point, what pipelines would be less than a million? Why the dollar threshold? Who would we want to keep out of this new statutory framework?
Madam Chair, again, I'm not certain what year it was that $1 million was inserted. I believe it was 1972 that this provision went into law in Section 120, 72 or 74.
Okay.
But $1 million then,
right,
was a bigger pipeline than would be today. And I could speculate as to that, but rather than do that, I think the question is at what point a pipeline becomes big enough, significant enough to affect the public interest that these kinds of protections and requirements should adhere and apply.
Absolutely. So just I'd encourage you between now and the next hearing to, even though I understand this is incorporating an original statute and making changes to it to marry up philosophical concepts, it reflects a policy decision that was made in a time. So either the policy decision is still good today and we need the dollar amount to coincide with that, or the policy decision at that point is no longer relevant and we would really want to regulate all pipelines with this structure. So I don't know the answer.
Okay.
But. Okay, so we'll let you continue walking through.
So sections 1 and 2 just make corrective references in other statute sections in Title 38. 3835, 121 is the new section in the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. Section 120 requires that a lessee make certain covenants to the state. 121 would put into place a set of additional covenants that a lessee would make when applying for a state right-of-way lease. And these additions that cover the next few pages here should look familiar. They are built on the must-haves contained in the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. Those things that we requested of applicants under AGIA that are intended to ensure that benefits of a project accrue to the citizens, businesses, and workers here in Alaska, as well as providing the kind of access and certainty and predictability around access to a pipeline that is important for additional exploration and development to occur. Okay. And so the first one is a commitment to solicit demand every 2 years for additional pipelines and the terms under which they would solicit that demand. Mm-hmm. Commitments to then seek the necessary approvals to make the expansion happen. Commitment to reasonable engineering increments, identifying what those increments might be based on the design of the pipe when it's first constructed. And then the commitment to expand on those increments and on commercially reasonable terms. Item 6, the commitment to treat those expansions on a rolled-in basis with a cap up to 115% of the day one rate. Item 7, distance-sensitive rates. Again, that was something that we asked for under AGIA for the big pipe. It's something that we think is applicable here as well. Item 8 gets to the Alaska Hire, Alaska Contracting, and using hiring facilities and networks here in Alaska to make sure that we benefit the citizens in the construction of a project such as this. Commitment number nine would be to negotiate prior to construction a project labor agreement, and that the lessee will commit to and acknowledge its regulation by the RCA under Title 42 under the Pipeline Act. Section 4 sets out the defined terms in the Right-of-Way Leasing Act for commercially reasonable terms and reasonable engineering increments necessary to make sure we get the right. We're all talking about the same thing in Section 121. And then Section 5 gets into the Pipeline Act itself and spells out that the covenants in Title 38 under the Right-of-Way Leasing Act are applicable to the lessee, and that the RCA has the jurisdiction then to enforce those covenants as a matter of its regulation of the pipeline provider. Section 6 allows for a conditional certificate to be provided by the RCA, and this goes back to the bigger picture in terms of what it is we're hoping to achieve in the next 2.5 years in terms of getting all of the major permits underway and basically accumulated and put together for a project to be sanctioned as early as 2011. And what this would allow the RCA to do is grant a conditional certificate and identify the conditions that need to be met. If, for instance, we had an application for a certificate on a particular project that didn't necessarily have a gas supply committed yet, we want them to be able to go through the steps at the RCA to be able to get their certificate, much like we do for conditional right-of-ways at DNR. You can get a conditional right-of-way granted that spells out the conditions that must be satisfied to make that right-of-way firm. So this would take that same concept and apply it to a certificate that's required by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and allow that same kind of head start, as it were, on the regulatory process to take place. Section 7, again, is spelling out the enforcement authority of the RCA, and Section 8 then makes a change to the definition of firm transportation service in the Pipeline Act that makes clear that firm service means you cannot be prorated if you're a shipper on a pipeline. And then adds the definition in Section 9 of common carrier that will allow somebody who has an existing right-of-way lease where they made the commitment to common carrier service mm-hmm. to be able to then offer firm service and interruptible service on that pipeline.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Senator Wilkowski, questions?
I'm just curious if I could, Madam Chair. I'm kind of curious about a little bit off topic, if that's okay.
Sure.
On the spur line, what is the status of ANGDA's work on the spur line at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, my understanding is that very recently, although the days are starting to run together on me. They entered into a reimbursable arrangement and paid BLM funds to continue on the EIS track that ANGDA is presently on for the Richardson Highway route on the spur line work. Beyond that, I'm not on a moment-to-moment update, but that's my understanding of the last bit of work that's been done.
And if I could, is the administration supportive of ANGDA's efforts to build the spur line?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have been supporting ANGDA since day one of the Palin administration. And the question is fundamentally how to evaluate what opportunities and needs there are for pipeline service in Alaska, and in terms of the spur line, the project that has been under pursuit here for the last 15 to 16 months by ANGDA, certainly is complementary to a large diameter project that would be going across the border and similar to that pursued by TransCanada and Denali. And in that regard, is very helpful to the overall delivery of gas to Alaskans. But whether or not that's going to be the right vehicle, whether or not we need to see a bullet line constructed sooner than a large diameter pipeline may come into service is something that we're attempting to spell out, flesh out, and understand more fully. It may be that Cook Inlet gas supplies reach a critical point here, whether it be due to deliverability or any number of other reasons. And because a bullet line requires such a long lead time to plan and construct, we want to get started now. And so that's been the focus here lately from the governor.
And just a couple more, if I could, Madam Chair. Does the administration have to sign off on expenditures by ANGDA?
Through the chair, that's a question that's starting to stretch my expertise. I'd be happy to find out.
Do you know if the administration has refused to sign off on expenditures requested by ANGDA?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, my understanding is the most recent request that came through for this work with BLM, $15,000 or so, was a little bit delayed, but did go through. One thing that we have been keeping an eye on is whether or not particular requests from for contracting authority and expenditure of dollars are consistent with A, the statutory mission of the authority, and B, the appropriations that were made by the legislature. And so that is something that we've started taking a closer look at as contract requests come through the door.
Do you know if there have been requests by ANGDA for expenditures that have been denied?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not aware of any that have been denied outright, but I'm not sure what the latest status of that is.
Okay. I'd appreciate if I could get an update on that. And I guess lastly, has the administration asked for changes in leadership at ANGDA?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, my understanding is that there have been conversations about various approaches, both in terms of overall direction and willingness to consider additional information, but those have been deliberative conversations that have taken place that I've not been a part of.
So the answer is, has the administration asked for changes in leadership at ANGDA? Your answer is?
I don't have an answer for you, Senator.
Can you look into that and get that
to me? I would be happy to.
Thank you. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions on the bill? We will, is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 136? Is there anybody online? Okay. So we will bring the bill back up again. I guess for me too, Joe, when you're thinking through, I'll ask more questions next time about whether or not these new covenants that are AGIA-like that will be put into place. I'd be curious to know of the companies that are considering, at least one company we know, a bullet line here in this state, you know, a little bit more detail about their reaction to the implementation of these covenants. And so I say that to you because my concern is that, you know, first, as a government, do no harm if you can. And sometimes getting out of the way is one of the best things that we can do. And our attempts to incentivize sometimes make for less incentive for the private sector. And I know that there is a company considering building a bullet line. We certainly need the project in Alaska, and I appreciate many of the covenants. I don't think the average Alaskan can look at them and say they wouldn't want to have those covenants, but you know, there's the possible and the perfect. And I just wouldn't want this committee passing out a piece of legislation that was going to interfere with the current business plans and the free market opportunity that we might have for a bullet line.
We'll certainly inquire with those commercial parties. The ones that we've had discussions with to date were aware of the administration's view and position on the need for these must-haves, and so they certainly were cognizant of, but I don't want to speak for them here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you for your time, and it is complex, and we appreciate you walking us through it. We'll bring it back up again and continue to take more testimony, and we appreciate your time. And with that, we're adjourned.